Good afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
Hello, Willis.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, we were not at the Shasta District Fair all week, so that was really a huge improvement in scheduling. We just went back to work. It's so great. Oh, my goodness. A lot of nice people, though. It was really fun. So, it's time to do another national security update because there's a lot of stuff going on and there is a tremendous amount of misinformation. Not even sure if we could quantify all of it. I just called today's show the world stage. I thought I'd give Claire a wide open field. So it's June 28th, 2025, and our guest today is Claire Lopez. I will give you the short bio, and I have posted the long one. We'll probably get into some of that. But she received her BA in Communications and French from Notre Dame College of Ohio and an MA in International Relations from the Maxwell School of Syracuse University. She completed Marine Corps Officer Candidate School in Quantico, Virginia, before declining a military commission to join the CIA. And then she did a bunch of stuff that she probably doesn't get to talk about anymore, but she learned a lot of things, and it makes her her insights super helpful and super valuable with all the things that that we're being told. Some of which I'm sure is true, some of which I'm sure is fiction, depending on who you listen to. But we just did a show with her May 25th, and that was really helpful. But I think probably the most useful show we've done with her, and we probably should hit the topic again, was in October of 2024. So if you still think that there is a two-state solution available and that Palestine is an actual country with a history and all that, I really, really hope you pop onto the page for today again, June. Oh, it's 29th, not 28th. That was yesterday when I did the page. God, it's hell to be a crazy person.
You're a time traveler.
Yeah, I was a time traveler. I was too. But the myth of Palestine and the two-state solution is what we called that program. We've aired it several times since, but honestly, it's something that is not promoted well, not taught for obvious reasons, and we have a lot of people who are completely in the dark about how that all works, hence the level of protest we see. So, Claire, now that it's not the 28th, it's the 29th, where would you like to begin?
Well, first of all, to thank you guys for having me back again. Glad to be with you on the show. And, yeah, you're absolutely right. There's an awful lot to talk about.
We appreciate you allowing us to force you to be our hostage for 2 hours. I realize your time's valuable, but I swear every time you come on, like, an hour, we're like, oh, it's over.
Just got started.
We just got going. So, you know, from your vantage point, just out of curiosity, like when you watch the reports of what's going on now, is there something that kind of lights your hair on fire? I guess to put a
well, specifically with regard to what?
You know, as you're watching the reports of what's going on now.
Well, I mean, in the United States, in Mexico, in Central America, in South America, in China.
Hey, come on. I already said it was the world stage. You could pick anywhere you want.
I think the main topic lately has been the Middle East and what's happening over there and a lot of misinformation coming from, well,
everywhere.
Everywhere, yeah.
Well, it is important to choose, you know, where to listen, where to read. For myself, I try to get a broad spectrum of media and inputs, think tanks also. And some of the best, you know, are the usual. Fox News is good. Also, Newsmax is very good. I myself, I'm often at One America News on their weekly briefing panel with John Hines. And then some of the think tanks that are really good include Jack Keane's, retired general, Jack Keane's Institute for the Study of War, very good, and also Hudson Institute is very good on a range of topics. Then as far as the media itself goes, I would add Breitbart to that list. A few more that'll come to mind, but those are the top ones that I try to consult, get inputs from all of them in my inbox every single day. Just the News, that's the one I mustn't forget. John Solomon's Just the News is also another very good one.
I like him.
Yeah, very much so.
He was always a really solid researcher.
Pardon?
He was always a really solid researcher when he came on
the scene.
Absolutely,
yes, yeah. Very reliable, very careful, you know, about doing their homework before they put something out.
Claire, one of the things that I don't know, I'm a little bit confused about is you hear people say, well, if the Iranian people, you know, could kick the mullahs out, that country would fall in line and we'd be okay. But these are the same folks that kicked out the Shah and gave us the mullahs that we have to deal with and have dealt with the last 40 years. Do you think if something happened to the Ayatollah, we would just end up with more of the same?
No, not at all. It's been 46 years since 1979, and the huge younger cohort of the population in Iran is two full generations removed from there. The people that form the majority of the population in Iran today have no idea what life under the Shah was even like. It's literally more than two generations removed. So the people there now very much would like to change this regime. And it's not just one Ayatollah. I mean, there's like tens of thousands of Ayatollahs in Iran. But, you know, what we're really looking at is a regime, a hierarchy that is made up of the Shiite clergy, the top ranks of the clerics in Iran, the judiciary, and then the military that props them up, the IRGC, the Pasdaran, the Quds Force, the Basij. All of these, by the way, of the military individuals and their headquarters, their facilities, were struck by the Israelis in Operation Rising Lion that preceded our own U.S. involvement about a week ago, which was called Operation Midnight Hammer. But all of those military organizations were hit. Many of their top leadership were eliminated, as well as quite a number of the Iranian top-level nuclear scientists. I've heard numbers anywhere from 15, 16, 18 people removed. That was the brain trust of Iran's nuclear weapons program. We're not even talking about their biological and chemical weapons programs, both of which they have, just like Saddam had them as well, yes, advanced, sophisticated. But put those aside, because the main concern right now has been the nuclear weapons program and the ballistic missiles that would deliver those warheads, which, yes, they were developing warheads. I think that's what prompted Israel to have to go to make that decision to move. There were places where the Iranian regime and, you know, some of those top scientists no longer with us were working on the final steps to adapt their warheads. Again, yes, they have warheads, adapting them to fit, to be placed, to be fixed onto the nose cones of their missiles. I'll add something to that, too, as it occurs to me here. You know, not only are the younger population in Iran, I mean, you know, about 35 and under, They are the ones in the streets. They are the ones, you know, multiple times since 2009 when we abandoned them before, in the streets protesting this regime, chanting or writing in graffiti on the walls, Mark Bar Khamenei, Mark Bar Dictator, which means death to Khamenei, the supreme leader, death to the dictator, him. But also there is a complete falling away from Islam itself. Shiite Islam is the state in a religion in Iran, but the young people are falling away in such numbers that they are having to close tens of thousands of mosques because nobody goes anymore. So it's a very different population, different people, different you know, experiences over the last 46 years than those who led the revolution against the Shah back in 1978-79.
So you think those folks that led the revolution, you think their numbers now are smaller than the general population, and that population
oh, yes,
will have
certainly
a chance to stand up and face, because the military is really what's putting all that down. I mean, they're the ones with the guns, and
that's right, yes.
I don't know that they would have the horsepower to really make that change, would they?
Well, here's another perspective on it. The Iranian population today is somewhere around 90 million people. But geographically, around the perimeter of Iran, are approximately 50%, maybe a little less, 48-49% of the Iranian population that are not Persian. They are Baluchis to the east, southeast. They are Azeris in the north. They are Kurds up against the Iraqi border to the north and sort of northwest. The Ahwaz Arabs to the east and the southeast. Some of these have been in armed rebellion against Tehran for years, especially the Baluchis, especially the Kurds, and especially the Ahwaz Arabs. They are armed. They are in rebellion already, and they're nearly or about close to 50% of the population. The other 50% is made up primarily of Persians, some other more minority groups that I haven't named too. But interestingly, the supreme leader himself is an Azeri. And those around him, some of those top-level people are also Azeri. But I'll tell you what is making a comeback, or at least maybe I should even say has never really gone away, and that is the people's remembrance of their own heritage. There's a reason why the language in Iran today remains Farsi. It is not Arabic, as in all the other Islamic conquests of, let's say, North Africa, elsewhere in the Middle East, and so forth. They all speak Arabic today, but not in Iran, because of the commitment, I mean, the absolute commitment to preserving the Farsi language, especially on the part of some of their greatest poets, like Hafiz, Ferdowsi, you know, the writers who gave us the Shahnameh, the history of the kings, right? They preserved the Farsi language. Yes, there are many Arabic cognates in it now, and flat-out Arabic words, yes, but they speak Farsi. They don't speak Arabic.
Hmm. Yeah, this is all the stuff that gets left out and why we don't really understand what's going on over there, because it all just looks like a big mystery and a lot of fighting.
Yeah, well, I think most people, if you talk to them, they would say that the majority of the population over there is Muslim.
Nominally so, but who does the polling, and how many are willing to say, no, I reject religion and I am just non-religious right now, or I'm atheist, or I have converted to Christianity? Who's going to tell a pollster that?
Yeah, right.
Right.
Somebody with a death wish.
No, that's not going to happen. But the truth is, from you know, accounts from people who have family and friends over there. There's not much left of allegiance to Shiite, especially 12er Islam, you know, the following of the 12th Imam, except among the top leadership. You know, as we said, clerical, judiciary, military, who are rigorously vetted for ideological purity and allegiance to the 12er eschatology. Aside from them, maybe their family members. That's about it.
I didn't know that. So it sounds like if they can get organized, that they may have a shot at turning that thing around and rejoining the world stage.
It'll happen. It'll happen. Now, exactly how or exactly when, not sure, we can say. But if we recall back in the days when the Shah was coming down, again, 78, 79, what really happened? What came together? A nationwide strike. Everything and every industry went on strike. Right now, we've had a trucker's strike in Iran for the last 3-4 weeks. Across the country, there are 31 provinces, and in every one of them, truckers went on strike. I think remain on strike. But now, if they would include the rest of the transportation industry nationwide, that would make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
The bazaars in Tehran closed down at least a week ago. Maybe it was even two. If the bazaars across the country shut down, that would make a big difference. If, you know, the oil industry, oil and natural gas industry workers shut down, went on strike, that would make a difference. And I'm not even talking about armed resistance at this point. I'm talking about how the Shah came down. Yes, there was fighting, you know, in the end, certainly. But what happened there in 78 and 79, again, also, is that elements of the Shah's own military, you know, there's the Artesh, which is the conscript regular army service, and then there are those elements I mentioned, the IRGC, the Quds Force, the Basij, and they're different. They're not the same. And in the 78-79 lead-up to the fall of the Shah, elements of his military, the Artesh, refused to fire upon their fellow citizens in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
They refused to shoot and kill, you know, their own people. If that were to happen, that even a number of units of the Artesh were to revolt, and go into rebellion against the regime, refuse to shoot or attack their own fellow citizens, that would make a difference. Have to wait and see.
Yeah.
All right. Let's take a quick break. We're going to come back with our guest, Claire Lopez. And we're looking at the world today, all the bits and pieces, primarily Middle East, and how that's going to affect everybody else. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Six gun in my hand, behind a gun, I make my final stand. It's why they call me.
Okay. Had a little sound challenge there. You know, it's not a Sunday without a little challenge. That's just how the world works.
Claire, the last time they had there, when they you know, ran the Shah out, that was the students were kind of up front on that. Is that where's the whole student mentality on the clerics now? Are they in revolt as well? I mean, are they going to support any kind of a revolution, do you think?
Well, it certainly has been the young people out front in the streets in all of the many uprisings from 2009. We'll recall the Green Movement, and Obama, of course, abandoned them all in the streets to be slaughtered. But very notable, I would say, was in September of 2022, another nationwide uprising. And we'll recall then that the young Kurdish woman, Mahsa Amini was her name, traveling with her family inside of a car in Tehran. And apparently her hijab slipped a little bit and some piece of hair was showing through the window. Horror!
Oh, the horror. Yeah.
And the car was stopped. She was dragged out of the car. She was dragged to police headquarters and bludgeoned to death.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
That was the start of the Zan Zendegi Azadi, women, life, freedom protest movement that lasted even really to this day, but was led in particular by young women, but the young men joined them too. So yes, in terms of the university levels of young people in Iran, they're at the front, of the protests that have gone on really throughout the 46 years, but especially more recently now.
And they're not followers of the Shiite movement, is that right?
Oh no, they're done with religion. I mean, it's not even that they're converting to something else, although some have converted to Christianity, yes. But in the main, they're just dumping religion. Period. They've had it up to there with it, and they don't want religion at all. And interesting, of course, some of the most organized and, leading Iranian opposition groups like the Mujahideen Khalq inside of Iran, the top biggest member of the NCRI, National Council of Resistance of Iran, the umbrella group for Iranian resistance, located with its headquarters literally two blocks down the street from the White House in Washington, D.C., But the 10-point plan is what I want to point out here. The 10-point plan of the NCRI leader, Mariam Rajavi, a survivor of the Khomeini regime, who fled eventually with their top people, now headquarters outside of Paris. She, in 2006, put out what she called the 10-point plan, and it is the statement of their plan, their program for an Iran after this regime. And among those 10 points are things like complete separation of religion and state, non-nuclear Iran, no more support for any Islamic terror groups, gender equality, protection and even autonomy for some of these ethnic groups that I mentioned earlier. These are things that any of us here in the West, in the United States, would support: a free market, capitalist economy. All of these are among the 10 points of their plan for how to change government in Iran. They're seeking a democratic republic. How to change that regime from what it is now, a brutally repressive Islamic terror regime, to one that is, again, a non-nuclear democratic republic.
Well, all of the, when you look back on all the pictures and things of Iran in the 70s and prior, it was really modern. I mean, it looked just like here. Everything was very modern.
They were moving in that direction, yeah.
And then suddenly, everybody's wearing a tablecloth, and women become, all the same. They could be anybody under the thing, and no options. Everything locked down. And just out of curiosity, that transition from, I mean, you know, women wearing shorts and bathing suits and all these
miniskirts on the campuses.
Right. I mean, it was just really
with the guys.
Yeah, just looked like here. How
normal?
How fast was that switchover?
It was pretty quick and pretty brutal. What happened is that after the revolution itself, and Khomeini, we'll recall, had been in exile first in Iraq for many years, and then the final, I don't know, year and a half or something spent in a place outside of Paris in France. But in February of 1979, in collaboration, listen to this, in collaboration with the Muslim Brotherhood, the Sunni Muslim Brotherhood, financed by a guy named Yusuf Nada, who is the founder of something called the Al-Taqwa Bank that financed both the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda back in years past, paid for not only that final exile at a place called Château-le-Neuf in outside of Paris, but also the flight back to Iran, February 1979, that plane landed. Supposedly there were going to be, this was what was promised, there were going to be elections, parliamentary elections. And so the various parties began to campaign and speak, and the leader, Masoud Rajavi, of the Mujahideen Khalq, which had actually helped to overthrow the Shah, who believed that the new regime under Khomeini would actually keep its promises about open, free, and fair elections. They believed that. And so he's campaigning, filling entire stadiums with people coming to listen to his campaign speeches. And very soon after that, from no more than 80-81, the Khomeini regime had established the IRGC, armed them, and they literally took to the streets and simply gunned down everybody, not just the Mujahideen Khalq, but communist groups like Today and the Fedayeen and others who had joined together to overthrow the Shah, absolutely just mowed them down in the streets, gunned them down by the tens of thousands.
Wow.
And that's when groups fled Iran and went next door to Saddam Hussein at the time, Iraq, found safe haven there, from which to carry on now in opposition to the Khomeini regime. But that's how quick it happened. And that quick, the women, I mean, this is Islamic law. This isn't something that parachuted in from Mars. This is Islamic law, 1,400 years old or almost, is embraced completely and totally by this regime. They are Shiite, which is, of course, the minority, about maybe 15% of worldwide Muslims, with the majority being Sunni, maybe around 85% or so. But this is straight out of the Quran, the Hadiths, the Sirah, the Sharia. There's nothing weird or odd or made up. This is faithful, devout adherence to Islam. And under Islamic law, women are to be subjugated. They are to be covered. They are to be subordinate to men who, in verse 434 of the Quran, are supposed to beat them if they merely fear disobedience from women. That's the Quran. They're not disobeying anything. They're not extreme. They're not radical. This is straight up the middle Shiite. Yes, Shiite, but Islam. The differences between Shiites and Sunnis have to do with not the doctrine, not the ideology itself, but rather things like the role of the clergy in leadership of the country, of the religion and the politics. Things like the keeping of shrines and grave sites, which Shiites do and Sunnis do not. Those are the differences. But as far as doctrine and ideology, absolutely mainstream, straight up the middle, nothing extreme, nothing radical about it. This is mainstream doctrine.
So how does such a small percentage of the population, you said 15%, how do they, or how are they able to seize control and maintain control of the rest of the population.
Oh, well, I meant in the world, Shiites are about 15% of all Muslims, and in the world, Sunnis are about maybe 85% of all Muslims. But in the country of Iran, it was first overrun by the Islamic armies back in about 642, 43 or so, and that was the Sunni Islamic armies surging out of what would become called the Arabian Peninsula. They were conquered. The Persian Empire went down to defeat. The Safavid Empire went down to defeat after having exhausted themselves in years before in battle with the Byzantine Empire, which went down shortly thereafter. So they were all Sunni. Well, they were not willingly Sunni, but they were forcibly conquered by Sunnis. But later on, in about the, 12th century or so, Turkic Shiite tribes from the north poured down and conquered Persia, as it was called then. And at that point, they forcibly converted everybody to Shiite Islam. These people never get a choice. It's not like some democratic election.
Right.
They're forcibly, you will convert to Shiite Islam or that's the end of you. Well, that happened maybe around the 12th century, but certainly by the 1500s, Persia was solidly Shiite. Solidly Shiite. And it remained so really until, I would say, the 20th century. And certainly now it is nominally still Shiite, but not in practice.
So what's the percentage of Shiites in Iran now? I mean, they hold power. Are they still a majority?
Nominally, we go back to who's taken the surveys, right?
Yeah.
So nominally, the country is still categorized as Shiite, majority Shiite. Obviously, they're not majority Shiite practicing or adherent. They're not. They're just not. But I don't think we know the numbers. That would be a very difficult thing to get accurately.
Yeah, I would imagine. Yeah, because who wants to pipe up and say that they're,
They're not.
They're not.
Christian or something.
Yeah.
Oh, because why? Because under Islamic law, to apostatize from Islam, be it Shiite or Sunni, is a capital crime. It is a death penalty crime to apostatize from Islam. So to openly do that in a country that's still under the tyranny of Islam, that's taking your life in your hands. You're going to get a death penalty.
And is there any type of judicial process, or do they just off? We saw you out there.
Yeah, it lasts about 5 or 10 minutes, and then they're taken out and shot.
Okay,
yeah.
All right.
Yeah, religion at the point of a sword. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. I mean, this is straight out of the Quran. Muhammad said, actually, I think it was Khomeini, people cannot be made obedient except by the sword.
Yeah, well, that's fairly
clear.
That's
how they think. I mean, if you call it thinking, but this is how they...
That's like how it works. So when people say, "Well, why don't they?" It's like, well, the consequences are slightly more severe than here. When we come back, I'd be curious. I don't know why or how you think that this has been sold in the United States, especially like on our campuses and all that stuff. That all this is some magical trip over there, and I've always fascinated the gay rights people and all that. I mean, if they went there, they get killed faster than the Christians, right?
They have no idea.
Yeah, not a clue. So let's hit that when we come back. Our guest is Claire Lopez. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Me and all my friends, we're all misunderstood. They say we stand for nothing, and there's no way we ever could. Now we see everything that's going wrong with the world and those who lead it. We just feel like
figure if Miriam Rajavi needs a theme song, we could give her that one. How do you think, I don't know, can anyone explain really what's going on in the streets of our cities these days?
Well, we're looking at a red-green alliance. It's not just the streets, it's the campuses, too. And in both those instances, we'll see collaboration and coordination among and between the forces of Marxism and communism and the Islamic movement in the United States that would be led by the Muslim Brotherhood and its front groups. They seek chaos. Overall, the two of them, both, the red and the green, seek chaos in order to foment a revolution out of which each of them think that they'll emerge on top.
How do they square all this? I mean, if they ever went there,
have no idea. We have seen some of these, you know, Mike on the campus or Mike on the street interviews people mm-hmm. have done.
Yeah,
hilarious, right? They'll put the mic up to somebody on the streets of New York or maybe the campus of Columbia University or someplace, and they'll say, something like from the river to the sea. Which river is that? Oh, I don't know. Maybe it's the Amazon. They have no idea.
No.
Well, which sea is that? River to the sea. So which sea? I don't know. Maybe it's the Bering Sea. They have no idea what they're talking about. They just know that it's cool and it's chic to put on one of those tablecloths, either the black checked ones or the red checkered ones, a face diaper on, and they run out and they're part of the cool kids club.
Yeah, and in reality, there is no tolerance for any of the things these guys are protesting for.
No, again, I was mentioning before how apostasy from Islam is a capital crime, death penalty crime. Well, there is a set of crimes, about seven of them altogether, called the hudud crimes and punishments that go with them. And the reason these are selected out is because these are mentioned in the Quran itself. And they include apostasy. They also include homosexuality. Not doing anything necessarily, just being homosexual. A few other things like highway robbery is in that group too, and a few more other crimes. But you get the idea. These are death penalty crimes in places where Islamic law is enforced. Now, there are lots of places, maybe, where people will claim to be Muslim, but Sharia is not actually enforced. But in Iran, it is.
Yeah.
And Gaza. We're talking about, if they want to go over there, Gaza. That is a place where the Gazan branch of the Muslim Brotherhood is called Hamas. That's an acronym, Harakat Islamiyah fi al-Iraq, Harakat Islamiyah Mukawamat Islamiyah, which means the Islamic Resistance Movement, and they enforce Islamic law. That's who they are. And if, some of these young idiots were to go over there, with their rainbow flags, they and the flags would soon be tossed off the top of a tall building.
Yeah, because, right about the time you get off the plane.
Not tolerated. It's simply not tolerated over there. And in many places, Iran is one of those places. Afghanistan is another. Pakistan is another. Somalia is another. The places where Islamic law is actually truly enforced. Now, many places in the Middle East, are nominally Islamic, like Saudi Arabia, for example, but many of the laws of Sharia are simply not enforced anymore.
Wow. Well, I constantly, And I suppose there's really no way to get through to any of these folks because none of this is ever brought up.
Well, not on the campuses, it's not. Because why? Because our campuses have been the target of both communist Marxist and Islamic infiltration for decades. The students who graduated, you know, way back, some of them at least, turned around and became professors themselves, moved on up through the ranks, became administrators, college trustees and presidents and so forth. And this is how it works, that ideology, those ideologies are perpetrated from generation to generation. And why so many Ivy League schools like Columbia, Yale, Harvard, and so forth, California, University of California campuses, Berkeley, and so forth, why they're so rotten, absolutely rotten to the core, anti-American, anti-Western civilization, the kids who go there and graduate from there haven't a bloody clue what is true and real in the world. They have no idea about America, you know, our foundational principles, foundational documents, not a clue. All they know is they've been pumped full of indoctrination for 4 years for an underwater basket weaving degree, and off they go trying to get a job and get their student debt forgiven.
Yeah, that's just insane. One of the reports I heard last week was following the airstrikes. Iran's on a big tear now where they're going out and executing yes. people they think were spies. Do you think that's yes. going to backfire on them?
Well, I mean, certainly it will within the country, but the point here is that we know that the Israeli intelligence service, the Mossad, had been operating inside of Iran probably for decades, at least years and years, and had established an extensive network of assets inside of Iran on the ground who not only helped them to learn what was going on inside of Iran's nuclear weapons program and ballistic missile programs, but also physically to locate and pinpoint the targets that, you know, the Israeli Operation Rising Lion eventually struck. How did they get, you know, the information to hit so precisely, you know, certain leadership of the IRGC? The IRGC Major General Commander, Hossein Salami.
Yeah.
The commander of the IRGC Aerospace, Hajizadeh. And all of those scientists that they eliminated. How did they get that information to send missiles literally straight through the bedroom windows while the entire rest of the apartment building was untouched? Okay, that kind of information comes from an internal network mm-hmm. on the ground. And I heard reported a week or more ago, 10 days ago, that the regime, through regime media outlets, Tasnim was one of those, that the regime was offering about the equivalent in U.S. money of about $1,000 for information that would name, identify Iranians who had worked with the Mossad. We also know, of course, the Mossad set up a FOB, F-O-B, a forward operating base in Iran. Remember this? Outside of Tehran, where they smuggled in the parts for drones and missiles, put them together, assemble them inside of that FOB, or FOBs, I don't know, maybe there were more than one, that were outside of Tehran, and there to counter any expected retaliation of firing of Iranian missiles once the Israeli attack had begun. And very effectively, right there on Iranian soil, they were knocking down any of these missiles they were trying, or drones, that the Iranians were trying to shoot off. They never got out of their silos, or they never got out of Iranian airspace. So that all was possible, was made possible by the incredible, courageous, on-the-ground resistance forces who are Iranian, and yes, some of whom are now being rounded up, and others, simply because they're Jewish, are being rounded up, jailed, probably worse, in retaliation, because the internal security forces of Iran are still functioning, at least to some extent. And yes, they are rounding people up, you know, killing a whole lot of them, jailing, probably, like I said, worse, torturing, killing them, just on suspicion of being Jewish or of suspicion of being assets of the Mossad.
Hmm. Do you think the Ayatollah survives this in the long run?
Do you mean the Supreme Leader?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, he's not really even an Ayatollah, you know.
What is an Ayatollah, anyway?
Well, no.
Like, what makes you an Ayatollah?
It's the clerical hierarchy, and you have to come up through a system of scholarship in places like the theological seminaries of Qom, the theological seminary city about middle or so of Iran. And you advance from one level, and there are specific levels from one to another, depending on your success in scholarship of Islamic jurisprudence and the law, you know. And so at the time, in 1989, when the Ayatollah Khomeini, the revolution leader, died in 1989, the designated successor was a grand Ayatollah. That's the tippy top, a Marzai Taqlid, grand Ayatollah, top of the clerical ranks. The Ayatollah Montazeri was the designated successor, but he had spoken out and criticized the prison massacre of 1988 at the end of the Iran-Iraq War, when then Khomeini, still alive at that point, knew that with the cessation of the war against Iraq and Saddam Hussein, the focus would then switch back domestically, and his domestic opponents, including the Mujahideen Khalq, would be the leaders of opposition to the regime now. And so Khomeini had something like 30,000 of them massacred inside the prisons, and the Grand Ayatollah Montazeri criticized that. So he was knocked out of the succession, and they had to find somebody else quick, because Khomeini had died in 1989. And so what did they do? They alit on this Khomeini, Ali Khomeini, who was only at that time at the rank, it's a middling rank, called Hujjatul Islam. Very middling. He did not have much scholarship. He didn't have students who followed him. He was not a Marzai Taqlid, which means somebody that they emulate and follow. He was just a middling rank, a journeyman, if you will, in clerical terms, Hujjatul Islam. But what they did then to make him the supreme leader, because they had to hurry, right? They bumped him up artificially to be called an Ayatollah, but he didn't have the credentials to be it, and never has had the credentials to be an Ayatollah. So he's not really, but he is the supreme leader.
But I guess if he can kill you, survive, I guess you call him Ayatollah if he says so, right?
No, we call him many things, dictator for one, and supreme leader for another. But he's 86 years old, not in the best of health, and you know, he is widely reviled and hated by many of the Iranian people. One way or another, he's not going to be around too much longer.
You think they'll toss him, or do you think that the revolution will change all that?
There are different possibilities. If the IRGC leadership, now, of course, minus their top commander, as I said, Hossein Salami, is gone, but, you know, whatever's left of the IRGC, decide that he's no longer an effective supreme leader, they could stage a coup and bump him out of there. At which point, you know, a military IRGC regime could take over. That would be a very bad thing.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
And we don't know if that could happen or not, but it's a possibility. Otherwise, if the people, as we were talking about earlier, take to the streets in mass protests, mass strikes across the country, and also elements, units of the Artesh, that's the army, the conscript army again, revolt, that could tip it over. We don't know yet. We don't know right now what's going to happen. But I'll tell you what, calling a ceasefire in the middle of winning the war really just took all the pressure off of the Iranian regime and freed them not only to restart their nuclear weapons program the best they can do with whatever's left of it, but also to crack down now, as we're seeing, on the Iranian people, abandoned once more.
Okay.
Abandoned. Just totally abandoned.
Hold that thought. We have to give 5 minutes for the news, and who knows, maybe the world will be totally different. We'll be right back with our guest, Claire Lopez. You're listening to We the People. Find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Tomorrow.